Craig Ballantyne parked the Land Rover and switched off the engine. He twisted the rearview mirror on its gooseneck and used it to adjust the angle of his peaked uniform cap. Then he looked around at the elegant new building that housed the museum. It stood in the middle of the botanical gardens, surrounded by tall palms and green lawns and bright beds of geraniums and sweet peas. Craig realized that he was putting off the moment and clenched his jaw determinedly. He left the Land Rover in the car park and climbed the front steps of the museum. "Morning, Sergeant." The girl at the inquiry's desk recognized the three stripes on the sleeve of his khaki and navy blue police uniform. Craig still felt vaguely ashamed of his rapid promotion.
"Don't be damn silly, boy," Barwu had growled when he protested at the family influence. "It's a technical appointment. Sergeant Armourer."
"Hi,"
Craig gave the girl his boyish grin, and her expression warmed instantly. "I'm looking for Miss Carpenter."
"I'm sorry, I don't know her." The girl looked unhappy at having to disappoint him.
"But she works here," Craig protested. "Janine Carpenter."
"Oh," she brightened, "you mean Dr. Carpenter. Is she expecting you?"
"Oh, I'm sure she knows I'm coming," Craig assured her.
"She's in room 211. Up the stairs, turn left through the door that says staff only, and it's the third door on the right."
Craig pushed the door open at the invitation of enter that greeted his knock. It was a long, narrow room with skylights and fluorescent tubes overhead, and the walls lined as high as the ceiling with shallow drawers, each with a pair of bright brass handles. Janine stood at the bench table, which ran down the centre of the room. She was dressed in blue jeans and a brightly checked lumberjack woolen shirt.
"I didn't know you wore glasses," Craig said.
They gave her an air of owlish erudition, and she whipped them off her face and hid them behind her back.
"Well," she greeted him, "what do you want?"
"Look," he said, "I just had to find out what an entomologist does. I had this bizarre picture of you wrestling with tsetse flies and beating locusts to death with a club."
He closed the door quietly behind him and kept talking as he sidled up to the table beside her.
"I say, that looks interesting."
She was like an affronted cat, back arched and every hair upon it erect. But slowly she relaxed.
"Slides," she explained reluctantly. "I'm setting up microscopic slides."
And then with fresh irritation in her voice,
"You know, you show the typical prejudice of the ignorant and uninformed layman. As soon as anyone mentions insects, you immediately think of pests like locusts and disease carriers like tsetse flies."
"Is that wrong?"
"Hexapoda is the largest class of the largest animal phylum, Arthropoda. It has literally hundreds of thousands of members, most of which are beneficial to man, and the pests are in the vast minority."
He wanted to take her up on the vast minority as a contradiction in terms, but his good sense for once prevailed. Instead, he said,
"I never thought of that. How do you mean beneficial to man?"
"They pollinate plants, they scavenge and control pests, and they serve as food."
She was away, and after a few minutes, Craig's interest was no longer feigned. Like any dedicated specialist, she was fascinating while talking in her chosen field. Once she realized that he was a receptive and sympathetic audience, she became even more articulate. The banks of shallow drawers contained the collection which she had boasted on their first meeting was the finest in the world. She showed Craig microscopic feather-winged beetles of the family Tiliidae, which were a mere 1/100th of an inch long, and compared them to the monstrous African Goliath beetles. She showed him insects of exquisite jeweled beauty and others of repulsive ugliness. She showed him insects that imitated orchids and flowers and sticks and tree bark and snakes. There was a wasp that used a pebble as a tool, and a fly that, like a cuckoo, placed its eggs in the nest of another. There were ants that kept aphids as milch cows and farmed crops of fungus. She showed him insects that lived in glaciers and others that lived in the depths of the Sahara, some that lived in seawater and even larvae that existed in pools of crude petroleum where they devoured other insects trapped in the glutinous liquid. She showed him dragonflies with 20,000 eyes and ants that could lift 1,000 times their own body weight. She explained bizarre forms of nutrition and reproduction, and such was her rapture that she forgot her vanity and put the horn-rimmed spectacles back on her nose. She looked so cute that Craig wanted to hug her. At the end of 2 hours, she removed the spectacles and faced him defiantly. "Okay," she said, "so I'm primarily the curator of the collection of Hexapoda, but at the same time I'm also a consultant to the Departments of Agriculture, Wildlife and Nature Conservation and Public Health. That's what entomologists do, mister. Now what the hell do you do?"
"Well, what I do is I go around inviting entomologists to lunch."
"Lunch?" She looked vague. "What's the time? My God, you've wasted my entire Saturday morning."
"T-bone steaks?" he wheedled. "I've just been paid."
"Perhaps I'm lunching with Rowley," she told him cruelly.
"Rowley's in the bush."
"Oh, how do you know that?"
"I phoned Auntie Vile at Queen's Lynn to check."
"You crafty little blighter."
She laughed for the first time.
"Okay, I give up. Take me to lunch."
The steaks were thick and juicy and the beer was icy cold, with dew running down the glasses. They laughed a lot, and at the end of the meal he asked,
"What do entomologists do on Saturday afternoons?"
"What do police sergeants do?" she countered.
"They go sleuthing up their family antecedents in weird and wonderful places. Want to come along?"
She knew all about the Land Rover by now, so she put a silk scarf around her head and dark glasses over her eyes to protect them from the wind, and Craig restocked the cool box with crushed ice and beer.
They drove out into the Rhodes Metopus National Park, into the enchanted hills where once the Umlimo had held sway, and the Matabili had come for succour and sanctuary in the times of tribal disasters. The beauty of the place struck Jeanine to the heart.
"The hills look like those wonderful fairy castles along the banks of the Rhine." In the valleys there were herds of wild antelope, sable and kudu, as tame as sheep. They barely lifted their heads as the Land Rover passed, and then returned to graze. It seemed they had the hills to themselves, for few others would risk being alone on these dirt-surfaced roads in the very stronghold of Matabili tradition. But when Craig parked the Land Rover in a shady grove beneath a massive bald dome of granite, an old Matabili guardian in the suntans and slouch hat of the park board came to meet them and escort them as far as the gates that bore the inscription, "Here are buried men who deserve well of their country." They climbed to the summit of the hill, and there, guarded by stone sentinels of natural granite and covered by a heavy bronze plaque, they found the grave of Cecil John Rhodes.
"I know so little about him," Jeanine confessed.
"I don't think anybody knew much about him," Craig said. "He was a very strange man, but when they buried him, the Matabili gave him the royal salute. He had some incredible power over other men."
They went down the far side of the hill to the square mausoleum of stone blocks with its bronze frieze of heroic figures.
"Alan Wilson and his men," Craig explained. "They exhumed their bodies from the battlefield on the Shongani and reburied them here."
On the north wall of the memorial were the names of the dead, and Craig ran his finger down the graven roll of honour and stopped at one name.
"The Reverend Clinton Codrington," he read it aloud. "He was my great-great-grandfather, a strange man, and his wife, my great-great-grandmother, was a remarkable woman indeed. The two of them, Clinton and Robin, founded the mission station at Carmi. A few months after, he was killed by the Matabili. She married the commander of the column who had ordered Clinton to his death, an American chap called St. John. I bet there was some interesting hanky-panky there. A bit of hithering and thithering, a touch of toing and froing, huh?"
"They used to do it even in those days?" Jeanine asked. "I thought it was a recent invention."
They wandered on around the side of the hill and came to another grave. Over the grave stood a misshapen and dwarfed misasa tree that had taken precarious hold in a fault in the solid granite. Like the one on the summit, this grave also was covered by a heavy plate of weathered bronze, but the inscription read, "Here lies the body of Sir Ralph Ballantyne, first Prime Minister of Southern Rhodesia. He deserves well of his country."
"Ballantyne," she said, "must be an ancestor of Rowley's."
"A mutual ancestor of both of us," Craig agreed. "Our great-grandfather, Bau's papa. This is the real reason why we've driven out here.
What do you know about him?
Great deal, actually. I've just finished reading his personal journals. He was quite a lad. If they hadn't knighted him, they would probably have had to hang him. By his own secret confessions, he was an unqualified rogue, but a colourful one.
So that's where you get it from, she laughed.
Tell me more.
Funny thing was, he was a sworn enemy of that other old rogue up there, Craig pointed up the hill towards Cecil Rhodes's grave. And here they are buried almost side by side. Great-grandpa Ralph writes in his journal that he discovered the wanky coalfield, but Rhodes cheated him out of it. He swore an oath to destroy Rhodes and his company. He actually wrote that down. I'll show you. And he boasts that he succeeded. In 1923, the rule of Rhodes's British South Africa Company came to an end. Southern Rhodesia became a British colony. Old Sir Ralph was its prime minister. He had made good his threat. They sat down side by side on the curbstone of the grave, and he told her the funniest and most interesting of the stories that he had read in the secret journals, and she listened with fascination.
"It's strange to think that they are part of us, and we are part of them," she whispered. "That everything that is happening now had its roots in what they did and said."
"Without the past, there's no future,"
Craig repeated the words of Samson Kumalo, then went on.
"That reminds me. I have something else I want to do before we go back to town."
This time Craig did not have to be warned of the hidden turnoff, and he swung onto the track that led past the cemetery, down the avenues of spathodia trees to the whitewashed staff cottages of Kami Mission. The first cottage in the row was deserted. There were no curtains in the windows, and when Craig climbed up onto the porch and peered in, he saw the rooms were bare.
"Who are you looking for?" Janine asked, when he came back to the Land Rover.
"A friend."
"A good friend?"
"The best friend I ever had."
He drove on down the hill to the hospital and parked again. He left Janine in the Land Rover and went into the lobby. A woman came striding to meet him. She wore a white laboratory coat, and her unnaturally pale face was set in a belligerent frown.
"I hope you haven't come here to harass and frighten our people," she began. "Here, police mean trouble."
I'm sorry, Craig glanced down at his uniform. "It's a private matter. I'm looking for a friend of mine. His family lived here. Samson Kumalo."
"Oh,"
the woman nodded.
"Oh, I recognize you now. You were Sam's employer."
"Well, he's gone."
"Gone? Do you know where?"
"No,"
flatly and unhelpfully.
"His grandfather, Gideon?"
"He's dead."
"Dead?"
Craig was appalled.
"How?"
"He died of a broken heart when your people murdered someone who was dear to him. Now, if there's nothing more you want to know, we don't like uniforms here."
By the time they reached town, it was late afternoon. Craig drove directly to his yacht without asking her permission, and when he parked under the mango trees, Janine made no comment, but climbed out and walked beside him to the ladderway. Craig put a tape on the recorder and opened a bottle of wine. Then he brought down Sir Ralph's leather-bound journal that Bawu had loaned him, and they sat side by side on the bench in the saloon and pored over it. The faded ink and pencil drawings that decorated the margins delighted Janine, and when she came to a description of the locust plagues of the 1890s, she was captivated.
"The old geezer had a good eye," she studied his drawing of a locust. "He must have been a trained naturalist. Just look at the detail."
She glanced up at him sitting close beside her. He looked like a puppy, an adoring puppy. She deliberately closed the leather-bound book without taking her eyes from his. He leaned closer to her, and she made no effort to pull away. He covered her lips with his own and felt them soften and part. Her huge, slanted eyes closed, and the lashes were long and delicate as butterflies' wings.